Find out first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com, on satellite, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70.
Day unabated, because most Americans are asleep, the plan for world domination goes forward, ladies and gentlemen, and only the handful of us that do this and listen to this and do the research know what's going on. Welcome to the broadcast. This is August 1st. We're already into the month of August as summer is just whizzing by, and we're happy to have you with us again for another broadcast of American Exposé. I'm Darren Weeks. Thanks for joining us here. As we explore the globalist plan to enslave us all with a one-world government system, such as it is, and we have to do everything we can to fight it because it's socialism and it's nasty. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope to get into some information about wind power. Some of you may know that the U.S. has just signed on to a new agreement, a climate deal with Asia, and I was looking for that article because I had come across it earlier in the week, and I went to AmericanExpose.com, and Dennis had already had the article there. So you saved me, Dennis. I appreciate that, and he's got a lot of other good stuff up there as well, as I was just looking before the broadcast. So AmericanExpose.com, spelled with a K, not a C, and go there and check out all of the wonderful research that he has posted there, because he does a lot of, evidently he spends a lot of time at it, because it certainly looks like he does. And so I appreciate that, and I appreciate the help. And also, SweetLiberty.org is another wonderful resource that we've tried to put together for those of you who want to know what's going on, and I know that's 100% of you, because you wouldn't be listening to a broadcast like this if you didn't want to know what's really going on in the world. Don't miss the partner sites on AmericanExpose.com. There's the Anti-Communitarian League. That's Nikki Rapata and Nordica, her daughter. They do some excellent research, and they need your support, ladies and gentlemen. To continue doing what they're doing, as like most of us, they've just about spent themselves broke. it seems like to be almost a litmus test with this movement. The number of people that have the money, those are the people you can just about be suspicious of. Because most of the people that are actually trying to do good for the country, unfortunately, are broke. And I wish it wasn't that way. The other side's very well funded, but there's a lot more of us than there are of them, and that's the thing you have to keep in mind. They may have the money, but we have ultimately the power because we have the numbers, and we just have to reach those people, get through to them, and there's the challenge. Because what we're in today, ladies and gentlemen, is an information warfare. Literally, we are going up against all of the established powers in the media, and we are trying to counter the constant bombardment of lies that takes place on a daily basis. And I'm pleased to be able to help try to confront the lies, but our scope is limited. And so everyone has a part in this. Everyone has a part in trying to spread the truth and combat the misinformation. The Anti-Communitarian League is up there. Also, the Information Corner, Sam and Trisha's website, theinformationcorner.com, and Joan Vion's The Women Group, womensgroup.org, I think is what her site is, womensgroup.org. Joan Vion does a lot of excellent information. She attends the United Nations conferences, and certainly she is more plugged in probably than anybody as to what's really going on. And there's a lot of other sites up there as well. We're trying to put these websites together in such a way that you can go there and share this information with your friends, your neighbors, and your coworkers. Anytime you have access to a computer and you have the ability to tell people about what's going on, once you can pull the documentation up, and you can pull it up, it especially helps if you can pull it up from an official source. I mean, right away, people will look at that information and realize that you're not just making this stuff up. And that's where you start to convert people over. And so, anyway, moving along with this information, we see from the BBC, U.S. agrees climate deal with Asia. The U.S. and five Asia-Pacific states have announced a surprise pact to cut greenhouse gases, which falls outside the Kyoto Protocol on climate change. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we've been telling you on this program that they're implementing Kyoto without signing on to Kyoto. See, these globalists, when they're faced with a setback, when they're faced with opposition, they'll just try their best to get it done another way. So we always have to be vigilant in our dealings with this stuff. They're very determined and they're very patient. It says the U.S. and five Asia-Pacific states have announced a surprise pact to cut greenhouse gases, which falls outside the Kyoto Protocol on climate change. China, India, South Korea, Japan, and Australia, and the U.S. account for nearly half of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. Now, I covered on Friday's broadcast some information from the actual scientists who stated that they have the opinion, they're of the opinion. And I mean, I quoted people from the UN's own intergovernmental panel on climate change, where they said that we're not comfortable with the whole Kyoto Protocol idea. And this is, I believe it was back in 1995 that they did this. They got together and created what they call the Leipzig Declaration. I believe that's how you pronounce it, Leipzig Declaration for Leipzig, Germany, where they met. And I want to share this with you one more time, just the declaration. I'm not going to share all of the information that I shared Friday, but I do want to share this short declaration that they wrote, because this is very important. This is the side of climate change that you're not being told by the controlled press. It says, as independent scientists researching atmospheric and climate problems, we, along with many of our fellow citizens, are apprehensive about the climate treaty conference scheduled for Kyoto, Japan, in December of 97. And of course, this was dated. This is back in 1995 that they met. This gathering of politicians from some 160 signatory nations aims to impose on citizens of the industrialized nations, but not on others, a system of global environmental regulations that include quotas and punitive taxes on energy fuels. Fossil fuels provide today's principal energy source, and energy is essential for all economic growth. And I would suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that that's the reason why they're doing this, because they want to cripple the developed countries. You see, people in developed countries have it too good. People in developed countries are comfortable, and they can't have you comfortable. They have to have you in turmoil all the time. They have to have you hungry. And that's, I believe, why we're being made dependent upon foreign food, as well as foreign fuel, foreign energy, and foreign everything else. Because whenever you have your sustenance, whenever you have the things that you have to have imported, rather than being able to have it locally produced, the chances for disruption of the distribution system is a lot greater. You see, you're able to... The people who oversee the whole process are able to control the whole process with ease. They say fossil fuels provide today's principal energy source, and energy is essential for all economic growth. Stabilizing atmospheric carbon dioxide, the announced goal of the climate treaty, would require that fuel use be cut by as much as 60 to 80% worldwide. I want to say that again. They say stabilizing atmospheric carbon dioxide, which, according to these scientists that I shared with you on Friday, is there's no scientific proof that carbon dioxide is causing any climate change whatsoever. So the stated goal of the Kyoto Protocol is something that doesn't even need to be done. It has not yet been established as even contributing to any kind of climate change whatsoever, or any kind of global heating or cooling for that matter. See, originally they were saying the world was cooling. Now they turn around and say that it's because obviously they were wrong about the cooling, so they're going to turn around and change the course and say, oh no, it's not cooling, it's warming. Yeah, that's right. The dog ate my homework. So anyway, stabilizing atmospheric carbon dioxide, the announced goal of the climate treaty, would require that fuel use be cut by as much as 60 to 80% worldwide. In a world in which poverty is the greatest social pollutant. And why is that, ladies and gentlemen? Because when you see, when you're able to produce and you're able to create wealth in a country, they're always rather fond of saying the United States is the largest polluter in the world. But you see, we're also well, we've been, anyway, the world's wealthiest country. And as the world's wealthiest country, we're in a position to clean up after ourselves as well. So in a world in which poverty is the greatest social pollutant, any restriction on energy use that inhibits economic growth should be viewed with caution. We understand the motivation to eliminate what are perceived to be the driving forces behind a potential climate change. But we believe the emerging Kyoto Protocol to curtail carbon dioxide emissions from only one part of the world community is dangerously simplistic, quite ineffective, and economically destructive to jobs and standards of living. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm reading to you right from the scientists. This document that I am reading has been signed on to by most of the world's climatologists. Now, why aren't you hearing that from the controlled press? They say, more to the point, we consider the scientific basis of the 1992 Global Climate Treaty to be flawed and its goal to be unrealistic. The policies to implement the treaty are, as of now, based solely on unproven scientific theories, imperfect computer models, and unsupported assumptions that catastrophic global warming follows from the burning of fossil fuels and requires immediate action. We do not agree, they say. We believe that the dire predictions of a future warming have not been validated by the existing climate record. These predictions are based on nothing more than theoretical models and cannot be relied upon. As the debate unfolds, it has become increasingly clear that contrary to the conventional wisdom, there does not exist today a general scientific consensus about the importance of greenhouse warming from rising levels of carbon dioxide. In fact, many climate specialists now agree that actual observations from weather satellites show no global warming whatsoever, in direct contradiction to computer model results. Historically, climate has always been a factor in human affairs, with warmer periods such as the medieval climate optimum playing an important role in economic expansion and in the welfare of nations that depend primarily on agriculture. Colder periods have caused crop failures and led to famines, disease, and other documented human misery. We must therefore remain sensitive to any and all human activities that could affect future climate. However, based on the evidence available to us, we cannot subscribe to the politically inspired worldview that envisages climate catastrophes and calls for hasty actions. For this reason, we consider the drastic emission control policies likely to be endorsed by the Kyoto Conference lacking credible support from the underlying science to be ill-advised and premature. That's the science behind Kyoto. It doesn't exist, ladies and gentlemen. And yet, every time you see a report, virtually every single time you see a report about some UN-inspired global document or some move toward eliminating greenhouse gas emissions, any news report that you come across, just about all of them, they say scientists say or scientists believe that that fossil fuels and greenhouse gas emissions are heating up the earth. And these are the scientists right here, and they're saying, nope, we don't buy it. There's no proof. So this is an agenda. This is an agenda by a powerful few to cripple the developed countries. And nothing could be clearer than that to me. If you have any thoughts on this, you're welcome to call in. 559-781-3773. 559-781-3773. I want to share with you a little bit about this agreement here that has been agreed to apparently by the BBC, or I'm sorry, by the U.S. and Asia, from the BBC. It says the U.S. and five Asia-Pacific states have announced a surprise pact to cut greenhouse gases, which falls outside the Kyoto Protocol on climate change. China, India, South Korea, Japan, and Australia, and the U.S. account for nearly half of greenhouse gas emissions, they say. The U.S.-led initiative would tackle global warming with new technology supplied to countries most in need. Now, once again, you got the redistribution of wealth. You got the developed countries funding the developing countries, so-called. Critics say the new compact undermines Kyoto, and there you have the Hegelian dialectic. It doesn't undermine Kyoto. It helps to fulfill the plan. That's why they're doing it. See, but you have to have a contest. You have to have competition going on. Because, oh, wow, it undermines Kyoto. Well, that's good then. No, it's not. Critics say the new compact undermines Kyoto and is likely to be ineffective because it is non-binding. Well, if it's non-binding, then why are they doing it? I guarantee you, in some way, it'll be binding. Because they'll see to it that it's binding. They're already piecemealing this thing through regulatory agencies and piecemealing it through Congress in certain respects. They say the pact will allow signed-up countries to set their goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions individually with no enforcement mechanism. The signatories argue it complements rather than weakens the 1997 Kyoto Agreement, which imposes targets on industrialized countries to cut their emissions. What a load of garbage. I mean, to start with, folks, how are you going to cut emissions? The only way that you're going to cut emissions is to cut transportation or to quit producing stuff. If you quit producing stuff, then you're not able to create any kind of wealth for your country, because production equals wealth. I mean, I'm not an economist. I'm not a rocket scientist here, but it's just common sense. Production equals wealth. And in order to stop emitting anything into the atmosphere, you have to stop energy. You have to stop production. What does that equal? That equals poverty, which is exactly what the United Nations say that they're trying to fight in Agenda 21. So, what's the real goal here? The real goal is international socialism, leveling the playing field, taking away from the haves and giving a little to the have-nots, but mostly crippling everybody so nobody can rise up against them. Australian Prime Minister John Howard said, quote, "The fairness and effectiveness of this proposal will be superior to the Kyoto Protocol. It demonstrates the very strong commitment of Australia to reducing greenhouse gas emissions according to an understanding that is fair in Australia and not something that will destroy Australian jobs and unfairly penalize Australian industries," unquote. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Robert Zoellick agreed the Six Nations, quote, "view this as a complement, not as an alternative," unquote, to Kyoto. Both the U.S. and Australia have refused to ratify Kyoto, which came into effect earlier this year, partly, they say, because big developing countries like India and China escape emission limits. And see, there you have the problem, part of the problem. They have also made clear their concern that climate change should only be addressed without harming development or economic growth. Australian Foreign Minister Alexander Downer told BBC Radio's Today program, quote, "Our view is you really need to focus on technological change to solve the ultimate change problem, and you do have to involve the major developing countries, which are very substantial emitters," unquote. A Chinese spokesman called the pact a win-win solution for developing countries. Well, I'm not going to go any further with that, because everything's a win-win for developing countries under the UN system. When you're at the bottom and you can't go any lower, the only place to go is up. But this is not going... ultimately, the UN system is not going to help the developing countries that much, because those people are still going to be working for what's the equivalent of maybe a buck or two. I mean... And the question that I have is, are we going to be facing a situation in America where we're someday going to end up being starved off of our land? Are we going to end up going to those developing countries and looking for work ourselves? Because there's not going to be anything left here for us to work at. I mean, you got the retail sector, but if you're not buying things, then retail establishments can't survive either. Moving along here, speaking of energy and sustainable development, another piece that Dennis put on the website is from Alternet, a website named Alternet. They say oil companies discover sustainability. It says, "Sustainability is big in corporate America today. The word, once an arcane term used chiefly by foresters and agricultural researchers, sustainable has become the label of choice that executives use to describe their businesses. Perhaps the most laughable of the newly sustainable corporations are the oil companies, pumping a finite resource like oil." And ladies and gentlemen, we've pointed out on this program repeatedly in the past, we don't know just how finite oil really is. According to Lindsay Williams, we're awash in oil in this country up in Alaska, where he lives and where he worked on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline as a chaplain in the early 1970s. And he says there's so much of it up there, I mean, it's literally squirting out of the ground almost. And yet the federal government refuses to allow the oil companies to develop but just a small portion of it. Pumping a finite resource like oil out of the ground must be one of the least sustainable endeavors on the planet, they say. But this doesn't bother the oil industry, which knows a powerful public relations word when it sees one. The most recent ConocoPhillips annual report has a section titled Technology Achieving Long-Term Sustainability, and the CEO writes of the company's sustainable growth plan. Annual reports from Chevron, Texaco, and ExxonMobil speak of sustainable development, and BP and Shell issue reports on the sustainability of their operations. There are even auditors willing for a fee to vouch for the statements in these sustainability reports. All of this when Arthur R. Green, lecturer of the American Association of Petroleum Geologists and former chief geoscientist of ExxonMobil, says world oil production is nearing its peak. And we've also covered also in the past, ladies and gentlemen, that some of those oil wells, there's evidence that a lot of the oil wells that they have thought they've given up on and thinking that they're running out of oil, they're actually refilling from beneath. And they've been able to, and in fact a lot of people think that maybe this is why Saudi Arabia has been able to supply the world. I mean, despite the fact that their oil wells have been beaten to death for many years, they're still going strong today. See, once again, you have to have a crisis. Saying that oil is short is like, more than likely, like saying water is short. That's another big one that they're saying today, that we have a shortage of water. How can you have a shortage of water when you're surrounded by oceans? You're surrounded by air which contains water. They say the history of U.S. oil production is instructive. Domestic oil output steadily rose until it peaked in 1970. Since then, production has declined despite the technological know-how of domestic oil companies and the considerable incentive of high prices. Domestic oil production in 2003 was less than 60% of its 1970 level. To meet our demand, we import foreign oil. More than 56% of what we used in 2003 came from other countries, and the proportion increases every day. It increases every year, rather. Increase, taper off, then decrease. World oil production will follow the same pattern. Some experts think world output is very near its peak already, while others say the peak will arrive sometime between now and 2050. And see, here's the situation. If we were really in this big of a problem with oil, why haven't they devised an alternative by now? I mean, they talk about many viable alternatives in the media to oil, and yet Bush is always blamed as being an oil man. So he won't do it because he's making too much money off of it. You see how they go back and forth between these things, ladies and gentlemen? We got to take a break here. We're going to continue this on the other side, and also I want to get into some wind information, because here's another energy so-called solution, and yet it's not going to work, according to this information. We'll get into this some later on after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to American Exposé. We'll be right back.
The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests, and are not necessarily those of the First Amendment Radio Network or its affiliated radio stations.
Most Americans want our government to control our borders, especially since 9/11. But amazingly, some political leaders want to do away with borders entirely. whether the American people agree or not. And they have a serious plan for accomplishing their aims while deceiving the public. It's called the Free Trade Area of the Americas, or FTAA, a huge power grab. If Congress approves the FTAA, our nation will be pushed down the same path that produced the European Union. There will be no more illegal immigration because there will be no enforcement of borders. Americans will lose control of their destiny as regional bureaucrats from corrupt political systems decide our future. Sound incredible? Check out the facts for yourself. Go to stoptheftaa.org. Then tell Congress you want a better future for America. That's stoptheftaa.org.
Now listen to me. The Bible says, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. I want you to know that a corporation is Caesar.
Government takeover of the church. This DVD is the most powerful tool we have for waking up those asleep in the pews. The scripture calls for his people to come out of her. The corporate church is the apostate church, the whore that rides the beast. Get this DVD for a donation of $25 from FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Make copies and give them away to your corporate church friends and loved ones. The truth will make them free. They will watch the DVD, Government Takeover of the Church. Order online today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com or call 559-781-3773. Who will tell them if not you?
American Exposé. I'm Darren Weeks. Go to the website, AmericanExposé.com, spelled with a K, not a C. Also, FirstAmendmentRadio.com is the place to go to support the network, as this network needs your support if you want to keep American Exposé and all the other broadcasts that are on this network on the air. And we need to do that, ladies and gentlemen, because free speech outlets are very rare these days. You call a talk show, they're more than likely cut you off if you tell too much information, too much real information. If you talk about Michael Jackson or whatever color Jennifer Lopez's fingernails are, you'll probably stay on quite some time. That seems to be the fare today. I work in broadcasting in the television capacity, and we air a lot of garbage, a lot of stuff that doesn't matter. In fact, almost 100% of everything we air is garbage. Garbage with a capital G. You'll never learn anything from the stuff we air in the controlled TV industry. And most of you know that. But First Amendment Radio is going to be changing satellites soon. And the new satellite coordinates are up on their website, FirstAmendmentRadio.com. We strongly urge you to check that out, especially those of you who are micro broadcasters or broadcasters of this network in some capacity. And we appreciate you folks that do this, that have the courage to rebroadcast good information. Thank you for doing that. All right, I want to forget about this article, Oil Companies Discover Sustainability, because time's getting away from us here on this program again. I'm going to get into this piece by L.M. Schwartz, Wind, Facts or Blowing Hot Air, because I think it's we all have to understand how we're being taken for a ride. And wind is being promoted as something that is sustainable, and some of it's cost effective, it's cheap, and it's good business. And the reality of it is a lot different than what they're promoting. So we need to explore this to some degree. I don't know, I more than likely am not going to get through this whole thing tonight. So what I'll do is I'll continue this on Friday's broadcast. So those of you who are listening tonight can hear the conclusion of it Friday as well. But L.M. Schwartz, and this is a piece that's put out by the Virginia Land Rights Coalition, it says, government agencies and the wind industry have successfully portrayed wind-generated electricity as green and as a price-competitive, potentially significant alternative source of power, which could reduce the dependence on dirty fuels. And dirty is put in quotes here. While wind-generated electricity may make sense in some circumstances, industry and government claims for its widespread use are not currently supported by sound science or economic analysis of cost versus benefits. They say despite the multi-billion dollar expenditure of taxpayer funds by government and the renewable energy industry during the past 35 plus years, the results have proven disastrous in economic terms. The Department of Energy and other federal and state agencies have spent over $40 billion on energy research and development and subsidies, not including the private research and development costs, yet virtually nothing has been developed that is technologically, economically, or environmentally sound. The subsidy of green energy such as solar, geothermal, hydro, biomass, and wind has distorted the operation of electrical power markets, increased electricity rates to consumers, increased taxes at all levels of government, diverted resources from industry-financed private research for more efficient and cleaner means of producing and distributing power, politicized energy production, and prevented or delayed bringing more base capacity online to reliably meet present and projected increases in demand. The current national debate on construction of wind farms is to a large extent focused on environmental and scenic issues and the effects on local property values. Depending on location and other factors, these questions may have merit. However, they are often a distraction from other important questions and are too often confused by political agenda and opinions or bias of opponents and proponents alike, which may have little to do with logic, sound science, or economics. But because of their subjective, emotional, or often controversial nature, these questions are not addressed here except as they relate to laws of economics and engineering. The basic economic factors and taxation subsidy policies affecting wind generation are well known and have been recognized in the United States and worldwide by opponents and proponents alike. There is little disagreement on basic economic realities. There is disagreement on the wisdom of government-mandated social engineering and economic intervention for which taxpayers and ratepayers are being forced to bear the substantial cost of waste, mismanagement, and even corruption. Public discussion of these issues is often limited because it is not considered pertinent to politicize energy policy. Industry and elected officials always seem to have a new plan to correct past mistakes. And mistakes, of course, is in quotes here, because are they really mistakes? The average taxpayer's electric ratepayer's ignorance of and confusion about wind power are largely due to the official bias and lack of factual information. So-called facts are rarely examined critically in the news media, nor does the general media follow the money to determine who gains and who loses. The purpose of this report is to examine some of the dollars and cents issues related to industrial-scale wind-generated electricity in order that the cost versus benefits can be rationally weighed. Since the late 1960s, the American public has been continuously subjected to predictions of impending environmental catastrophe resulting from modern industrial technology and processes. Radiation, air, and water pollution, depletion of natural resources, deforestation, acid rain, global warming, overpopulation, extinction of endangered species, and ozone depletion are but a few of the highly publicized threats, quote-unquote, to life on Earth. With each passing week, some new danger emerges. usually based on faulty science and blown out of proportion by politically motivated environmental organizations and media pandering. Public fears are heightened and elected officials are pressured to, quote, do something. Doing something usually means spending huge amounts of taxpayers' funds and enacting numerous new laws and a maze of complex regulations, almost without exception, to the detriment of the average citizen. All too often, logic, fact, and sound scientific and economic analysis are ignored. They don't make good headlines or improve a politician's chances for re-election. You know, folks, the politician I would be more apt to vote for would be the guy that agrees to just stay home and not do anything. We've reached the point where, you know, I would almost be willing to pay him just to sit home and do nothing. I mean, the country would be so much better off. But they say they don't increase the politician's chances for re-election. Fear does increase the politician's chances for re-election. And once again, that's assuming that we have honest elections in the first place. Optimism and faith in man's intelligence and ingenuity to overcome technical problems in the quest to improve our standard of living take a back seat to government intervention. Political solutions result in paralysis or worse. In times of crisis, quote-unquote, whether real or fabricated, the general public has been conditioned to accept the idea that someone has got to do something. That someone, of course, is government. Instead of doing something themselves, John and Jane Public expect and demand government must find a solution to the quote-unquote problem. And government officials, along with their corporate partners, are only too happy to oblige. They are here to help us as long as John and Jane Public consent to be taxed, regulated and manipulated, and remain relatively content in a state of mental stupor and physical dependency while being fleeced. Is there constitutional authority for federal tax credits, subsidies, research grants, and similar expenditures of public funds for wind power or for any other type of electrical generation? Well, the significance of this question is directly related to the economic, social, and moral consequences of decades of federal energy policy, yet it is brushed aside by as being irrelevant by most elected officials, and seems to be of little concern to most Americans, despite the fact that they give lip service to free markets, individual responsibility, and constitutional government. The key to American economic, cultural, and industrial achievement and productivity has been the organic constitutional limitations on the power of government to interfere with private, productive, and peaceful human endeavors and with the marketplace. According to James R. Glassman of the American Enterprise Institute, quote, abundant low-cost energy is the key to prosperity, and prosperity is the key to cleaner air and water, as numerous studies, including a survey of 117 countries by the World Bank and the World Economic Forum, have shown, unquote. The World Bank. Government produces nothing. It can only redistribute wealth created by private initiative or destroy it. When constitutional prohibitions on federal authority are ignored or rejected, the rights and market choices of individuals are limited and become hostage to the ambitions of powerful, politically connected special interests who are the beneficiaries of government's wealth redistribution schemes, exactly what has happened in the field of alternative energy. Politicians and renewable energy special interests have, in fact, socialized the costs of this boutique form of electricity production. And you're going to find out why this person is causing it a boutique form of electricity production, because it doesn't have really the capability of producing electricity that's going to be useful. That's what they're getting at here. It's for show. Boutique. By legislating that all taxpayers and ratepayers must shoulder the largely hidden expenses of enriching a few corporations and individuals, politicians are able to buy the votes of uninformed citizens, claiming they are doing something to preserve the environment provide jobs, and reduce our dependence on dirty fuels? The clear answer to the question posed is there is no more constitutional authority for subsidizing wind farms than there is for peanut farms, Christmas tree farms, or corn farms, ethanol. There may be limited constitutional authority for regulatory oversight of interstate and international commerce pertaining to generation and distribution of power, and for enforcing contracts. There may be some limited authority to establish certain technical standards to protect citizens' safety and property. But as long as Americans ignore constitutional prohibitions against federal funding for energy production and allow political and bureaucratic tampering in the marketplace, we will continue to suffer from shortages, price distortions, and power disruptions, and continue to pay a premium for electric power and the Kenneth Lays and the Enrons, locally and nationally, will continue to work their magic on taxpayers and ratepayers. I find it interesting, as I pointed out on Friday's broadcast, isn't it interesting that California is one of the most environmentally advanced states in the country, and yet they're the state that's being threatened with so many power outages? And is this the wave of the future for the rest of the country as we become more environmentally sustainable? Wind power has been portrayed as the scrappy underdog of the energy industry, facing the powerful interests of Big Oil and King Coal, who are out to crush the green threat to their energy empires. The truth is nearly the opposite. Many of America's largest corporate conglomerates have for decades been the prime movers and shakers in renewable energy, and they have used their political and financial muscle to gain favorable tax and marketing treatment. Beginning in the mid-1970s, Mobil, ARCO, Shell, Exxon, Amoco, BP, and Enron were just a few of the heavy hitters engaged in projects for renewable energy research and development. Their actions were and are seen by some advocates of renewables as indicative of the potential for renewables' competitiveness. But total private sector investment in 1995, for example, was less than 1% of total investment worldwide in all forms of energy. Proponents have constantly argued for the need for continued subsidies for wind, using the rationalization that commercialization is just around the corner. For instance, in 1985, the American Wind Energy Association testified before Congress, quote, "The goal for this industry, the achievable goal, is the lowest cost source of electricity available to a utility by 1990, unquote. Yet the subsidies continue, and wind power advocates continue to demand they be expanded. What motivated multinational oil and gas conglomerates to become more involved in renewables, when U.S. generation from these renewable sources is only about 2% of the total market? That's the question. U.S. generation from these so-called renewable sources is only 2% of the total market. So it doesn't make business sense, you wouldn't think, that these multinational oil and gas conglomerates would become involved in renewables. To a large degree, it reflects the company's deep involvement in a sustainable development and corporate social responsibility movement that's all the rage among ideological environmentalists, UN and European Union bureaucrats, and corporations that hope to reap big bucks from the new regulations governing the use of energy, resources, and just about everything else. Wind power, along with other sources of renewable energy, has been portrayed as a cheap, inexhaustible, and benign source of electricity compared with fossil fuels or nuclear energy. Some proponents have even claimed it is free energy. Producing electrical power involves the conversion of other forms of energy into electricity. Whether it's wind, coal, solar, or nuclear, there is no such thing as free, clean, or safe electric energy production. Every form of conversion and distribution has economic, environmental, and human safety costs, with some forms of conversion costs outweigh the benefits. Some costs are apparent and are paid directly by the consumer in their monthly electric bill. There are also hidden costs, such as government subsidies and tax credits, which are spread out and paid by all taxpayers. And there are additional hidden costs, which are imposed on power suppliers, and they're imposed by the government through legislative and regulatory mandates, which in turn are passed on to the electrical consumer as part of their monthly bill. The average consumer is not aware of the economic and engineering complexities of electric power generation, transmission, and distribution. He or she expects the lights to turn on at the flick of the switch, the refrigerator to keep the food cold while the family sleeps. The consumer sees power lines everywhere and believes all that is needed is a wire from the nearest pole to the house, and bingo, we're in business. Only during a power failure, when a dark room fails to respond to the light switch, do we realize how important power is in our daily life. Like the air we breathe, we don't really think about it until it's missing. Now, renewable energy, particularly wind power, is highly problematic. It's ill understood and expensive technology. The popularly held idea that government can mandate green energy and that the wind generators can be hooked up to the grid, thus providing reliable, inexpensive extra capacity to meet demand or as a substitute for other fuels, is a foolish notion, as simplistic as it is false. The vast system of electricity generation, transmission, and distribution covering the United States and Canada is essentially the world's largest single machine. The grid system makes it possible for utilities to engage in wholesale electric power trade, allowing utilities to reduce power costs, increase power supply options, and improve reliability. The system has evolved into three major power grids, which also include smaller power pools. They're the Eastern Interconnected System, consisting of the eastern two-thirds of the United States, the Western Interconnected System, consisting primarily of the Southwest and areas of the Rocky Mountains, and the Texas Interconnected System, consisting mainly of Texas. The interconnected utilities within each power grid coordinate operations and buy and sell power among themselves. Due to its physical characteristics, electricity follows the path of least resistance. Thus, the flow of electricity within the electric power system must be closely monitored and regulated to ensure sufficient generating is available to meet demand. Demand for electricity fluctuates continuously based on factors such as time of day, season, and the characteristics of the territory served by the system. Overall, reliability planning and coordination of the interconnected power systems are the responsibility of the National Electric Reliability Council, or the NERC, which was voluntarily formed in 1968 by the electric utility industry as a result of the 1965 power failure in the Northeast. The NERC's 10 regional councils, isn't that interesting that they have 10 regional councils, cover the 48 contiguous states and portions of Canada and Mexico. I wonder what the boundaries of the 10 regional councils are. I wonder if they're anything like Nixon's 10 regional councils. The councils are responsible for overall coordination of power policies affecting reliability and adequacy of service in their areas. They also exchange operating and planning information among their member utilities. In the past, wholesale trade has been dominated by utility purchases from other utilities, wholesale power sales by non-utilities to utilities, and wheeling, which is, remember this term, folks, wheeling, that is the transmission of power from one point to another. That's called wheeling. I say wheeling by utilities have both grown vigorously since the mid-1980s. Whether this growth will be sustained is uncertain. The rate of growth slowed considerably between 1990 and 95. Historically, almost all wholesale trade was within NERC regions. However, utilities are expanding wholesale trade beyond those traditional boundaries, and wholesale trade between NERC regions is also growing. Now, prior to deregulation, and that word is in quotes, because it wasn't real deregulation, prior to deregulation, quote-unquote, which began in the 1990s, regional and local electric utilities were regulated vertical monopolies. A single company controlled generation, transmission, and distribution in a given area. Each utility generally maintained sufficient capacity to meet its demand, and long-distance energy shipments were usually reserved for emergencies, such as unexpected outages. In essence, the long-range connection served as insurance against sudden loss of power. The limited use of long-distance connections aided system reliability because the physical complexities of power transmission increased rapidly as distance and the complexity of interconnections grew. Power in an electric network does not travel along a set path. When utility A agrees to send electricity to utility B, A increases the amount of power generated while B decreases production or has an increased demand. The power then flows from the source to the sink along all the paths that connect them. This means that changes... Now, see, bear in mind, folks, we're talking about wind farms. That's the point. That's why we're doing this. Okay? And you never really can predict how much power wind farms are going to generate. And with the power grid, everything is immediate. Demand can change immediately. Supply with wind farms can change immediately. Because if the wind picks up, you're suddenly generating a whole lot more. This means that changes in generation and transmission at any point in the system will change loads on generators and transmission lines at every other point, often in ways not anticipated or easily controlled, they say. To avoid system failures, the amount of power flowing over each transmission line must remain below the line's capacity. Exceeding capacity generates excessive heat, which can cause the line to sag or break, or can create power supply instability, such as phase and voltage fluctuations. Capacity limits vary depending on the length of the line and the transmission voltage. Longer lines have less capacity than shorter ones. In addition, for an AC power grid to remain stable, the frequency and phase of all power generation units must remain synchronous within narrow limits. If a generator drops two cycles below 60 cycles, it would rapidly build up enough heat to destroy itself. Circuit breakers trip a generator out of the system when a frequency varies too much, but much smaller frequency changes can indicate instability in the grid. In the Eastern Interconnect, a 30 millicycle drop in frequency reduces power delivered by 1 gigawatt. Well, I'm sorry we're out of time. There's so much more to this, and maybe we'll continue this on Friday. I'm not sure yet. But you're listening to American Exposé. Thanks for being with us this time on the broadcast. And we've got to go. But I'll be back Friday. Chris will be back with you tomorrow. And join us then, folks. Do your research. Pray for this republic and do what you can to restore it and spread this information far and wide. God bless. Good night.
Be sure to listen to The Church at Kaweah every Saturday and Sunday at 7 a.m. and 11 p.m. Pacific Time. The Church at Kaweah is a Lordship Church under the sole authority of Jesus Christ. You may contact The Church at Kaweah by calling 559-561-4860. That's 559-561-4860. And let them know how much...